Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week, we pick a history book that we find interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week, we're happy to have Katie Turton on the show. Her Forgotten Lives, The Role of Lenin's Sisters in the Russian Revolution, 1864 to 1937, has just appeared. I read the book with great interest because I had read several Lenin biographies and noted that women were very important in his life, and particularly his sisters. Katie has cleared up a lot of questions for me, and so I enjoyed talking to her, and I hope that you enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Good. I'm very well. Things are sunny here in the center of the United States, the heartland, as we call it. I don't exactly know what it has to do with hearts, but that's what we call it. We're very happy to have Katie Turton on the show today, and she's the author of a book that I read with great gusto because it's, believe it or not, a pet topic of mine. The book is called Forgotten Lives, The Role of Lenin's Sisters in the Russian Revolution, 1864 to 1937. And I have to say, not to show my cards, but I thought it was a wonderful book. I really did, and it answered a lot of questions that I had had about Lenin. I mean, I think I told you in an email, Katie, that I had read Robert Service's, what I thought was a very good biography of Lenin. And, you know, these women just keep showing up. He's always surrounded by them, or he's with one of them, or one of them is feeding him, or one of them is, you know, writing letters to him, or one of them is proofreading his books, or he's proofreading their books, or, you know, it was just fascinating to me to see that, you know, that he had lived surrounded in this kind of family circle by these women. And so I was really appreciative of your efforts, and I thought it was great that you allowed us to learn a little bit more about them. And we'll talk about the book in a second, but right now, if you would, I'd like you to talk a little bit about yourself and tell us where you're from and where you grew up and how you became interested in history.
Okay. Thanks for having me, first of all. I went to university at Aberdeen, where my hometown, in fact, and my initial undergraduate degree was English and history. I did a joint honours. But from the start, I always leaned more towards the history side, and as soon as I met the lecturers who specialised in Russian history, I knew what my own special topic was going to be. Mm-hmm. I worked with two fantastic lecturers, David Longley and Professor Paul Dukes, and their inspirational teaching really captured my imagination.
That's funny. I know Paul Dukes quite well,
actually. Do you?
Yes, I do.
you'll understand how inspirational.
Yeah. No, he's a fantastic guy.
Yeah. So at that point, I decided that Russian history was the way I was going to go, and I wanted to do a PhD. So I went off to Strathclyde University down in Glasgow to learn Russian for a year. And then from there, I went on to Glasgow University itself to do the PhD.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it was a complete fluke, if you like, that I ended up with the topic of Lenin's sisters. Basically, the woman who ran the language course at Strathclyde was married to James White, another fairly famous Russian historian who had just done a biography of Lenin.
Yeah.
And when I spoke to her about wanting to do a PhD, she mentioned her husband, and he suggested the topic of Lenin's sisters.
I
have to admit, at that point, I didn't actually know Lenin had sisters.
That's funny.
Absolutely. I mean, I've always been heartened by the fact that when I speak to other academics, a lot of them don't realize that Lenin had sisters either. But it was a fantastic topic for me because it covered both the revolutionary period, which was my key interest, but it also obviously brought in women's history, which is my other main concern.
I know. When you emailed me, I just, because it really is the case, I'm not exaggerating at all, when I read Service's biography, I said, you know, the most fascinating part about this is his family life, not just his family life, but these women, because they were so incredibly important and interesting. I think it was I think it's an absolutely terrific topic, and we'll talk about it in a second. So then you started to write the PhD, and this book is the result of the PhD. Is that right? This was your dissertation?
Yes.
Rewritten into a book. Uh-huh. And why don't we just go ahead and talk about the book itself then. So we know how you got the topic. How did you execute it, so to say? I mean, I noticed one thing that I thought was fantastic is that the Russians were apparently very generous in the archives with you. You got to look at things that I thought they were remarkable.
Yeah, I've never been sure why it was that the access was so open. I mean, I spent three I had three sessions in Moscow working in the archives, and I was allowed access to basically all the personal files of the sisters. I sometimes wonder if it's because they don't see them as important, or if they don't see them as potentially having a threat of some kind, or that there's no controversy in their past. But obviously I wasn't going to point anything out to them, you know, that they were more important perhaps than they realized. So.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. But I mean, the list of primary sources that you got, which is very well laid out in the book, I mean, it's truly, it must have been such fun.
Oh yeah,
to work
absolutely.
Through those materials. I mean, I've been in Soviet archives, and I didn't have as much fun as you did, I think.
I think my favorite letter was seeing an original letter from Stalin to Maria with the Stalin signed in blue pencil. Which that was a bit of a thrill, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. I can only imagine, like, just seeing something like that. It must have been incredible. So why don't we go up directly to the topic of the book itself, and it's about really on the most general sense, it's about Lenin and his family, and primarily his sisters, primarily two of them, Anna and Maria.
Yeah.
You also have quite a bit in there about Nadezhda Krupskaya, who was his wife. So why don't we begin at the very beginning and talk about Ilyich's family life, where he was born, and where did he arrive in the birth order and that kind of thing?
Okay, well, the Ulyanov family was it was enormous. There were three sons and three daughters, and then two other children who died in infancy, unfortunately. And it's not a myth that his childhood was this idyllic experience. You know, loving parents who believed that all their children were equal, that they should have all the same opportunities. Summer spent sort of running around in the countryside and playing in orchards and just achieving well at school. And what's fascinating is that there's really nothing in their early life that might point them to a more radical future.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously they were brought up by progressive parents with a liberal outlook, but it's such a sort of normal childhood, if you like, that it always perplexes. I think it's quite perplexing to see how their lives then change.
And so is Alexander, who's the second born, I think, is he the first one actually to kind of pick up radicalism?
I would say that Anna and Alexander, Anna being the eldest and then there's Alexander, they both go off to university at the same time, and I'd say that their very first experiences were absolutely equal in the sense that they both got involved in student politics and discussion circles. I think the quirk of the Russian system at that point was that even political discussions were so frowned upon by the state that before you knew it, the most innocent of conversations could be more political and more radical than they would in a more open democratic context.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously Alexander takes a step further, which Anna does not, and falls in with a group that have decided to act out their revolutionary ideas in acts of terrorism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, their plan was to assassinate the Tsar.
Yeah.
Yeah, it didn't get very far. The police were apparently quite effective at infiltrating those organizations because they captured Alexander pretty quickly. Isn't that right?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, the plot was thwarted. They managed to intercept telegrams and had been watching the members of the group as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a telegram that Anna, in fact, received, which was sent to her as a clean address that the police didn't recognize, that draws her to the police's attention and means that she too is accused and in fact punished for being part of a group that she hadn't actually been involved in.
Uh-huh. And how did the Ulyanov family respond to Anna's and Alexander's address? They were in Petersburg at the time, is that right?
They were outside St. Petersburg, down in their family estate, and by this point the father had died, and it's never clear if he knew anything of what his eldest children were experiencing at university. I mean, obviously there was shock, but to your credit, Alexander and Anna's mother immediately dropped everything, went straight to St. Petersburg to plead on their behalf. He saw the police chief and so on, appealed to the Tsar himself, visited her children, and did everything she could to have their sentences alleviated. Obviously, she failed in Alexander's case. He was hanged. But she did manage to have Anna's sentence of 5 years of Siberian exile changed to 5 years of exile at the family estate. So she was allowed to bring Anna home, acting as her guarantor, if you like.
And did this radicalize the rest of the children, at least the ones who were alive at the time? That would be Olga. She was alive. And Volodya there, little Vladimir.
I mean, Maria and Dmitry are have been born by this point as well, but they're so much younger that they're not really, certainly not politicized. And even with Vladimir and Olga, there's all sorts of myths that this is the moment where Lenin suddenly decides his whole future path. But really, there's just shock, a desire to find out what had actually happened, and a kind of step-by-step retracing of what Alexander had been up to, and indeed what Anna had been involved in as well. And there's just a gradual build-up over time into much more radical activities, not least when they finally go to university themselves, Lenin and Olga.
Yeah, I see just what you mean. So at what point do Anna and Vladimir and Olga, I guess at this point, do they encounter the Social Democrats, that is the Marxist Party?
Once you get into St. Petersburg, by this point, I mean, Anna's kind of stuck at home at this point in her exile, but Olga goes off to university in St. Petersburg. She's allowed to go there. Now, she doesn't actually meet the Social Democrats, but just she meets people who are future Social Democrats, if you like, and then unfortunately dies. Lenin has had to do his law degree by distance, but when he then goes, when he visits Olga, it's then that he first gets involved in revolutionary circles, meets people like Krupskaya, and from that point is integrated into the Social Democratic movement. I mean, the party itself is formed 1898, so...
1898, which is, Lenin was born in 1870 or something like that, and so he was a mature person when he encountered them. Were they reading Marx at the time?
Yep, absolutely. There are quite a lot of the Olga herself, for example, and Anna, and had notebooks in the archives where they were, notebooks that they had jotted down as they were reading from Marx.
Amazing source. Yeah, that's an amazing source. So then we should think, and I think you portray Anna and Olga until she died, and then Vladimir as all having been radicalized in this way and all being interested in radical thought, including Marxism.
Yes,
at the time. So, I mean, and that's an interesting revision in and of itself, because when you read the history of, the Bolshevik Party or the Menshevik Party or the SDs in general, they're usually left out. And Olga, no one ever reads about them. Maria comes along a little bit later, and we'll talk about her. So at this time, what were relations like within the Ulyanov family between Anna and Olga and Vladimir and then later Dmitry is born, I guess. Is it Dmitry? Is that right? And then Maria finally comes in. What kind of a family was it?
It was a very close-knit family. I think we were close and loving and supportive. I mean, what was interesting was that, while biographers would tend to paint Lenin as the center of the family, it's to me it was a much more complicated picture where, until his death, Alexander was very much sort of the favorite son. And even after his death, obviously continued to have a very sort of emotional place in the family's memory. There's interesting age gaps between the sisters and between the brothers. So in fact, it was boy-girl pairings that you got within the family. So
you mentioned that,
Anna and Alexander were buddies. Olga and Vladimir were also played together. And then Dmitry and Maria again sort of paired up because by the time they were growing up, Anna and Alexander had left the home.
Yeah.
I mean, there's also ups and downs. There's stories of Anna falling out with Maria while she's still grieving for Alexander. The stories of Lenin tormenting Dmitry as a boy. So, it's also a normal family and having its ups and downs and fallouts. But
it does seem to me to be a remarkably... maybe this is just because I'm an American from the heartland that I mentioned before, a remarkably intellectual family. I mean, they're real readers and real talkers. I think you found that in their correspondence, too. I mean, they're people of ideas. Ideas really matter to them.
Yeah, very much so. They're all avid readers.
I mean, they read multiple languages.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, they all have ambitions to sort of apply that knowledge as well. Olga sort of has ambitions first of being a doctor, then of a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
If there's one person who sort of doesn't have that same kind of confidence, it's Anna, and she thinks about perhaps becoming a writer. So mm-hmm. in some ways, she is perhaps the less, slightly less intellectual one of the whole family, but it's, I think it's more of a confidence issue. But certainly the rest of them, they all have ambitions to apply their knowledge, to write, to produce their work, particularly once they're into the Bolshevik Party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think this confidence issue is very interesting, and I appreciated what you had to say on it as a teacher, because it's not to anachronize here, but it's so often the case that my female students don't have the confidence that they should. And you can clearly see that with Anna and Maria, who had spent almost their whole lives in the revolutionary movement. When they come, you have a great part of the book at the end when I guess they're basically repeatedly asked to write what are biographical sketches of themselves, autobiographical sketches, and they just won't do it. Or they don't know how to do it.
Yeah.
Because they're so used to talking about other people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was one of the first sort of obstacles, if you like, for actually researching them, because obviously the first port of call is their own memoirs, their own autobiographies, some of which are published and some in the archives. But they do almost everything they possibly can to deflect attention what they did. Obviously, a lot of their time is devoted to talking about their relationship with Lenin and how they helped him.
Yeah.
But if you stop there, it'd be quite easy to believe that they didn't really do a great deal themselves.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. There's also something, I mean, we should just tell people that don't know, there's also something about the kind of Bolshevik ethos in that. Skromnost, you know, was a very, this kind of humility was a very important thing, and Lenin himself was really quite a stickler about that. I mean, he wasn't a fan of any sort of cult of personality, even though one became associated with him. So why don't we take the story forward a little bit? Who first decides to become a professional revolutionary among them?
I've never actually thought about it in those terms.
They all end up as professional revolutionaries.
Yes, I mean, Lenin's path is easiest to trace because he's sort of he's in St. Petersburg. He probably is the one who's freest to get involved. Maria's still very young. Anna's stuck at home in exile.
Yeah.
But as soon as she's free to get involved as well, she goes back into the movement and quite quickly establishes herself. And as soon as Maria's old enough, as soon as she comes to university, she and Dmitry get stuck in, if you like, in student circles, and then obviously with the party itself.
Yeah.
It's based on age hierarchy, really. It's how they join the movement.
I see. But by let's say roughly 1900,
yes,
they all are heavily involved.
Yes, absolutely. And roaming Russia and beyond, fulfilling their party duties.
Yeah. So let me ask this, because I think I'll come back to the heartland. You know, one of the questions Americans like to ask other Americans is, how do you make your living? What do you do?
Yeah.
How did they live if they were professional revolutionaries? How did they put bread on the table? Not that they were rich or anything. It's kind of an interesting logistical question.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the features of the underground revolutionary movement that a lot of the most prominent revolutionaries were actually from nobility background of some kind and had independent wealth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, would actually freed up their time to get involved. The Ulyanovs had become nobility through their father's work in the civil service. He'd been made a nobleman through
right.
his work.
Mm-hmm.
So,
they have a pension then.
Yes, the mother has a pension and also her own estate, which she shares with her sisters.
Yeah.
So in fact, you can say that the mother, Maria, actually bankrolls a lot of her children's activities, and she's the one who's sending money to them, posting bail, but sending them abroad and so on. All of them publish in some form, particularly translations. So Anna translates from Italian, sort of children's stories.
Right.
Lenin's obviously writing as well. Krupskaya is interested in education.
Uh-huh.
But Maria works as a teacher and as a governess.
Yeah.
but obviously it's a very sort of patchy existence.
Yeah, and, no, they're hardly wealthy, that's clear.
Yeah. Anna's husband as well also has to be borne into, taken into account. He has a very successful career as working in an insurance company and various other posts.
Yeah, that's Mark.
And,
yeah.
Yeah, and he actually seems to be able to hold down his post even though he's a revolutionary, so his income is there as well.
He keeps his day job, so to say. Yeah, no, that's another interesting difference between then and now. I think that, again, at least in the United States, I can't speak for Scotland, parents tend to cut their children off after a while.
Yeah.
does not last into your 30s. No, it just does not. So there's another interesting moment here. I thought if my memory serves, Lenin is sent – he is actually exiled to Siberia for a certain amount of time, correct?
Yes.
Now, does Maria follow him there? And basically, I want to use these words carefully. Does he take care of him? I mean, what is that relationship?
When Lenin is sent off into Siberia, it's his wife Krupskaya that follows him.
Oh,
they basically agree to marry so that they'll be able to live together.
Uh-huh.
And then Krupskaya's own mother goes out and stays with him. Maria's actually sort of finishing up university at this point.
I see.
She remains in central Russia.
Okay, yeah, I got that wrong. Yeah. No, because my thesis is that Lenin never cooked a meal in his life. I don't know.
Oh,
you think that's true?
That's eminently possible, absolutely.
Because he always had these people there, even in exile.
Yeah, very much.
I mean, cook his food for him. Yeah, no, I'd think about that, you know, because I cook 3 times a week in my family.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, I'm very, I'm not a Bolshevik, but I'm a very modern guy. So then take us to the... So Lenin, between 1900 and about 1905, where is Lenin living? Is he in Zurich at the time? I can't remember.
Yes, from Siberia, he goes pretty much straight off into Europe. He's in various places. He's in France, he's in Zurich, and so on. Basically, because it's easier for him to sustain his revolutionary ties out of police surveillance. On the other hand, his sisters actually are able to stay in Russia, and they continue to be active in various towns.
And where is Anna at the time?
Well, Anna goes to various places. She works in Moscow and St. Petersburg.
Uh-huh.
She goes to Saratov for a while. They're all in Kiev. Dmitry, Maria, and Anna are in Kiev in around 1902 to 1904.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest, it's quite hard to keep...
They're
constantly moving to escape police attention and so on.
Right. I mean, that's another thing we should tell the the listeners, that the police were all over these people like, as we say, white on rice. I mean, they were always under surveillance, constantly under surveillance. So they did have to move a lot, and their doors were being broken down, and, you know, stuff was being confiscated, and their papers being read, and it was a constant sort of thing for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's a curious mixture in the underground period, because on the one hand, you're right, the police are incredibly efficient. They have I've seen the surveillance reports, I've seen the papers that have been confiscated. And yet, on the other hand, when they did actually catch hold of them, it is not unusual for, particularly, say, Maria, to be released without charge. I mean, having been held for 3 months or whatever, but still being released without charge, not being sent into exile. I mean, there's a kind of mildness about the police force in terms of sentences.
No, you're exactly right. It was really quite a different mentality than we associate with police states, because, you know, just 30 years later, if you did anything like this, you would have been put up against a wall. I'm reminded of this, and I can't really remember. I think I read this in the Service biography. Again, this has been 5 years ago. But when Lenin was sent into exile to Siberia, the government moved his library for him.
That's probably true. I mean,
can you imagine?
I know, it's astonishing. I mean,
he had a big library and he wanted to read in Siberia, so they said, "Yeah, sure, we'll move your library for you."
Well, absolutely. Well, I mean, he was even allowed to travel under his own steam. You know, you're given a few days in the capital to tie up your personal affairs, and then he hopped on a train and traveled, well, presumably first class, all the way to Siberia.
Astoundingly genteel, really. I think it's amazing. So then, between the period about 1900 and 1905, Anna and Maria both hold party posts, don't they? I can't remember exactly what they were, but maybe you could describe them.
Well, the main activities for the sisters was usually on what they'd call the technical side of the party. They're not the ones publishing their latest thoughts on political questions.
Yeah.
They're the ones who are coding and decoding letters and correspondence between revolutionary groups. They're organizing the travel for revolutionaries who are trying to flee Russia or move to a different town. They're distributing leaflets producing the leaflets in the first place, uh-huh. They're working for newspapers. So it's a kind of work that disappears in bigger, more general works on the revolution, but it was the very work that kept the revolutionary movement
yep.
going.
Yep, yep. Yeah, I know they pay a lot of attention to the printing press. I mean, this is something that I think that our students will forget about. But to them, the printing press was life. And they're constantly working on pamphlets and going places to get pamphlets and reading other people's pamphlets and writing pamphlets and editing pamphlets. It's as if the pamphlet is kind of the sort of central, iconic element in the entire movement. And Maria and Anna were really... They were involved in what Russians called «дело производства». You know, they were working through these papers to make
yes.
sure that, you know, to use a bad metaphor, the trains were running on time in the revolutionary movement.
Yep. Yes, very much so. And I mean, some of my favorite sources to work with were, Maria's letters to colleagues saying, "You're not doing the code properly, or your chemical ink, your invisible ink, didn't work,
yeah,
and the letter
right.
was ruined. Be more careful.
Yeah,
follow the technique properly," and
yeah,
so on.
Yeah, no, that's very funny. So then, 1905 happens, and for those listeners that don't know, there was a big revolution in Russia in 1905, and this sort of galvanizes the party. And does Lenin return at that time? I can't remember.
Yes, he returns briefly in 1905, but he's not able to stay very long, obviously, given police pressure, and heads back into Europe. But he still maintains, you know, one of the key links that he maintains with the revolutionary movement in Russia is through his sisters, who are always reporting back to him about what's going on, visiting him from time to time. So there's a constant exchange of information across
uh-huh.
the border.
And then after 1905, what posts do Anna and Maria hold? What do they do then?
It's much more of the same thing. I mean, one of the significant places that they go is Saratov, where they sort of revitalize a party that has been
squashed
by the police. They get it going again, get more members, they're able to send delegates to one of the many party congresses, they revive a newspaper, and manage to spend a good 2 years there working. But as usual, the footsteps of the police aren't far behind them. Maria is sent off into exile up into the north,
uh-huh.
and Anna has to sort of move on.
Uh-huh.
And by this point, she has, of course, adopted a son as well, so
right.
there's slightly more domestic considerations that she has to bear in mind.
Yeah, so Anna, as you said, marries a fellow named Mark, who's also yes. in the movement but holds a day job working as an engineer, I think, and
mm-hmm.
they adopt... Georgi or Gloria, I can't remember his name.
Yeah, Gloria.
But then Maria never marries, does she? Is that right?
No, she doesn't. And it's sort of endless amusement to Trotsky, who sort of disguises as an old spinster. But I think there's evidence of one relationship with another revolutionary. But obviously Maria never writes anything about it
uh-huh.
herself, except
yeah.
sort of. Small mentions in letters, but
uh-huh.
the relationship doesn't seem to have lasted. And then the revolutionary was actually killed in the First World War. So,
uh-huh.
and after that, there's not much evidence of any other relationship.
Now, would you say that one of the interesting things about all of these people, if I could generalize a little bit, is the lack of the thorough romanticism of the movement, but no actual romance. They are not very big on love. There's just not very much of that. Why is that?
It's a difficult question. I mean, Martov's sister famously said that the Lenin sisters were cold women, and so it's a strange sort of change from their very sort of close family circle that in later life they don't seem to have had much of in the way of romantic relationships. I mean, Anna's relationship with her husband does appear to have been a love match, but if you go to their flat, which is preserved in St. Petersburg, you
mm-hmm.
know, they had separate bedrooms, and I suppose other things just mattered more to them.
I think that's right, if I could just jump in for a second. I mean, I do think that they were married to the movement. Again, that's kind of a hoary old metaphor, but I really think that was the very first... That was really their calling and their love, and it was the thing that they did and the thing that they had devoted their lives to an extent that I don't think we can really understand. We don't have things like this, and at least here in Iowa we don't. I don't think we do. So I found it very interesting that they had really, because they were also all workaholics. I mean, what we would call workaholics. I mean, they were, you know, Anna and Maria worked 12 hours a day as far as I can tell.
Oh, easily, yeah. It's astonishing. I mean, it wasn't unusual for them to work until 2 or 3 in the morning.
Yeah.
And I mean, the physical ailments that they all suffer, particularly after the revolution, is indicative of the physical strains of their life before the revolution as well. You know, living in you know, prison conditions, the constant stress of police attention, and just sheer hard work for days upon days.
So. Yeah, no, it's astounding. So let's skip from 1905 all the way to 1917. What were the roles, so to say, of Anna and Maria, and I suppose we could talk about Krupskaya as well, in the revolution itself?
Well, there's another sort of classic moment in Russian history where the women disappear. You know, there's been a lot of work on Bolshevik women and their contribution, but get to 1917 and they sort of disappear. But, you know, they're not sort of speaking on the podiums, obviously, unless they're Alexander Kollontai. They're just all working behind the scenes. Maria and Anna go straight to what they do best, which is newspaper work. So between the February Revolution and the October Revolution, they're publishing Pravda, they're publishing more pamphlets, they're commenting on events and so on. And then as soon as the government is formed, once again, they're simply trying to find roles supporting it in any way that they can. Maria continues to work for Pravda, becoming the executive secretary. Whereas Anna pursues another sort of lifelong interest and goes into children's welfare, joins the department that's being formed, and starts looking at children's homes and care for orphans and so on.
Now there was some controversy, I guess, as to how they got these posts.
Yeah.
And you engage that in the book. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you get comments from observers and from historians as well that, you know, they basically got these posts because they were related to Lenin. It was, they were figureheads, essentially. They didn't have serious jobs. But there's two things to remember. First of all, that basically Anna and Maria simply continue to do the type of work that they've always done. So they are qualified for the posts that they end up with. And the other important thing is that there's so few loyal Bolshevik personnel as the government is formed that everyone who had any connection with the Bolsheviks were getting posts. I mean, it's how everyone got their job, that they knew Lenin, their husband was in the party, and so on. So it's not a specific case of nepotism relating to them in some ways. It's simply that everyone simply pitched in and were given a job to do.
No, I can see how in hindsight it might look like nepotism, but I think
if you understand
the situation, which was basically a kind of a fire drill where they were just trying to get everything done. I mean, people don't really understand, I think, how close the Bolshevik regime came to collapsing.
Well,
because they couldn't manage affairs. They just didn't have the bureaucratic... I was going to say manpower. They didn't have the bureaucratic personnel to actually get the job done.
Yeah,
And they did work all the time. I mean, I've read these things where they just basically don't sleep.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And they're working with the same privations. I mean, they get slightly more food because obviously they're working in the government, but they don't have any fuel in the Pravda offices. They have to burn old newspapers. Maria can't get a pair of scissors. So... you do get a sense reading their own autobiographies and other testimonies that, you know, everyone was going through the privations that Russia experienced,
even
though they were at the heart of government.
It doesn't sound like it was any fun. So in 1917 or 1918, where is Anna? Where are Anna and Mark? Are they in Petersburg?
Anna initially stays in St. Petersburg when the government moves to Moscow, but she soon follows. Mark, unfortunately, dies after the revolution and was buried up in St. Petersburg. So from that point on, Anna has her own flat, but she's obviously in close contact with Maria, Lenin, and Krupskaya, who are actually in the Kremlin.
This is the part I wanted you to talk about, because I think I think people don't realize this, and I really it had not come to my full consciousness until I read it again. I'd read it in service, and I read it in your book, and I'm like, so Krupskaya, Maria, and Lenin share a small flat in the Kremlin.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's what they've been doing for the last 20 years. I mean, Maria often stayed with Lenin and Krupskaya in Europe, in Russia. So it was kind of a natural step that they continue to live all together.
So I think that they constitute a small family.
Very much so.
I think you can probably say. Now, then there is a lot. There's a lot to be said. I mean, I can only imagine the psychological. And I think actually you show. Let me issue you a compliment. I think you show really admirable restraint on the sort of psychological front, which is to say, you know, these three people, all of whom were very independent personalities, all of whom were united in this kind of world historical cause, lived together for, I don't know, how many decades? A long time. I mean, they lived cheek by jowl for a long time. I go home every night to my wife and my son, and I think, well, this is going to be great for a couple hours. No, don't tell my wife I said that. But I can only imagine, you know, how that would shape somebody psychologically, living together like that for 20 years. You know, Lennon was not an easy guy.
He clearly wasn't
an easy guy.
Yeah.
And you know, it was, that really must have been something. So I guess could I ask you to unrestrain yourself a little bit and talk a little bit about the dynamics of Krupskaya, Maria, and Lennon in their small flat in the Kremlin or wherever?
Yeah. Obviously, it's most famously addressed as this sort of three-way relationship when Lennon falls ill. And there are lots of reports of Maria and Krupskaya having huge rows and disagreements over how Lennon should be cared for and so on. It wouldn't be a surprising thing if there were rows all the way through their Kremlin life as well. I mean,
people who live together fighting. I've never heard of such a thing.
What happens though when some historians get their hands on it, though, is that it begins to kind of eclipse everything else that was going on, and you know, the fact that they made up the day later and went on holiday together kind of gets forgotten.
Exactly.
But I think the interesting thing is that, I mean, Krupskaya and Maria did form a very strong bond, I think, in the underground period before the revolution. You know, they recognised the shyness in each other. They certainly got on better than Krupskaya did with Anna. So I don't think that ever went away. And, you know, even after Lenin's death, even if that central point had disappeared, they still chose to live with each other. So
yeah, no, that's exactly right. I did notice, and I don't think I'm wrong in saying there's a certain amount of editorializing in the cover shot on the book. Which shows, it's a marvelous picture, by the way, of Maria and Krupskaya arm in arm.
Yeah.
Walking, yeah, so I got that. But still this stuff persists.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of these tropes that you learn about, that that they were at each other's throats and that they hated one another and, you know, that they were kind of, to put it in the language that I think many of the old commentators wanted to say but didn't, that they were both spiteful bitches.
Yes, that's essentially what is suggested. I mean, Trotsky himself doesn't pull his punches when he's talking about their relationship.
Now, Trotsky, that is a spiteful bitch right there. Trotsky.
Yeah. Well, this is it. I mean, I think it's always one of the difficulties when you're a feminist historian writing about women, because you want them to be perfect, you want them to be nice to each other, and you want them to be the best at everything.
Yeah.
And it was important to suggest that there was an alternative perspective, but I knew that I couldn't claim that they didn't fall out. You know, that you have to sort of offer the sort of what I hoped was a well-rounded perspective on what their relationship might be like.
Which is to say, they were people.
Yes, exactly.
Not cardboard cutouts. They were actual people who did actual people stuff, like the rest of humanity does. So then, let's after the building of the Soviet regime, maybe you could say a few words about what they were up to.
While
Lenin was alive, let's like take it to the point where Lenin actually gets sick and goes to Gorky.
Okay. Well, Anna works in the Department of Children's Welfare, facing an uphill battle trying to get resources to look after the orphans. And Maria continues to work as the executive secretary of Pravda, so which was obviously, it wasn't the same as being the editor, but she saw to the day-to-day management of the whole newspaper. She was also heavily involved in what was called the worker correspondent movement, which was all about getting ordinary workers to write into Pravda and talk about their lives. And she sort of became seen to some extent as a kind of voice of the people. You know, people in trouble in Moscow would appeal to her and ask for help. And Anna and Maria would both try and use their influence and their position to help people get accommodation, get a job. Mm-hmm. And so on. Now, Anna's actually nearing 60 by this point, so her career sort of begins to slow down at this point. She goes to work for the History of the Party Department, basically writing about the revolution, establishing the party line. And Maria takes a bit of a career break when Lenin falls ill. She goes off to Gorky with him to care for him. But they're both quite public figures. You know, they're talked about in the press, their role in the revolution is discussed, and as I say, they're sort of guardians of the people, if you like.
Mm-hmm. I see. Now, is it mentioned that they are Lenin's sisters at this point?
No, it's interesting that it tends not to be mentioned before Lennon's death. Anna is referred to using her married name, so the connection isn't clear.
Yep.
And I mean, obviously Maria's full name is used, but she tends not to be described as Lennon's sister. And it was probably a very conscious choice on all their parts that the relationship wasn't to be seen as important.
And they never called him Lennon, did they?
No, absolutely not. No, it was Volodya usually.
Volodya, yeah, exactly. Yeah, they never called him. Yeah, no, it's exactly right. So then Lennon falls ill, goes to Gorky, and there is some controversy about how he should be cared for and so on and so forth. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, this is the point where political and personal tensions sort of come together. Anna's not really involved in the caring for Lennon, but Maria and Krupskaya are obviously there. And while Maria thought that visitors should be kept limited, that Lennon shouldn't be disturbed and so on, Krupskaya was very keen to keep him informed, believing that it was political intrigue and action and so on that sustained Lennon. It's never really resolved, but what it does begin to do is sort of set up divisions between the two women that will continue to be present as Stalin begins to maneuver himself into a position of influence and power. Stalin obviously falls out with Krupskaya over her sharing information with Lenin that he didn't want
to. Yeah, maybe you could talk a little bit about that, because it seems to be somewhat important in terms of, well, it's important in a number of ways that you know better than I do, so why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Well, basically, Krupskaya continued to keep Lenin informed of disputes, discussions, particularly controversies with Trotsky, and Stalin got wind of this and phones Krupskaya and gives her an awful row on the telephone. Maria has left a kind of astonishingly horrible description of this moment where Krupskaya is crying and she's sobbing and she's rolling on the floor.
Rolling on the floor, yes, rolling on the floor.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Now, this was never published, and I'm not sure I even got to the bottom of why she would have written it, but it certainly sets up that Krupskaya and Stalin are going to be enemies for the next few years. Maria, on the other hand, is much more sympathetic to Stalin. She accepts his apology for shouting at Krupskaya. And after Lenin's death, she continues to support him as he's beginning to rise up to power, whereas Krupskaya is much more seen as an oppositional figure. And the whole thing culminates with a party congress where Krupskaya stands up with the opposition and criticizes Stalin. And then Maria stands up and essentially defends Stalin and tells the opposition to fall back into line.
Yeah, I think that most people would. Again, we kind of tend to see the entire Soviet experience from the point of view of 1937. So when we talk about opposition here, maybe you could tell the listeners exactly what is meant.
Okay, well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing to remember. I mean, in the 1920s, we don't have the terror and the violence that we're going to see in the 30s.
Right.
This is a discussion about the route the party is going to take in terms of leadership. Obviously, Trotsky has been dismissed and denounced as a possible successor to Lenin. Stalin is emerging as a leading figure. And you have debates going on about is he gaining too much power? Is he sort of taking the party even closer to dictatorship versus an opposition which is talking about sort of collective leadership and saying that no one can replace Lenin. Tied in with that, you've also got big economic debates as well, where Stalin, first of all, stands against the left who are aiming for rapid industrialization, whereas he's taking a softly approach with Bukharin. And having defeated them, he then turns around and defeats the very people he'd just been defending, in particular Bukharin, who had said that industrialization should be gradual and in cooperation with the peasantry.
And the consequences of defeat become more and more severe as time goes on. I mean, defeat at one point meant that you had to say that you were wrong and that you would support the party line. But by 1927, you get kicked out of the party. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's much greater stress and sort of pressure being placed on people who aren't following the party. So Maria, who had been a kind of supporter of Stalin alongside Bukharin, finds herself being labelled with Bukharin as Stalin turns against them both. And you get these sort of horrendous sort of witch hunts on the go where Maria sort of hauled before the Central Control Committee. She's asked to denounce Bukharin, not only at the meeting, but she's supposed to write things against him.
She fails
to defend him, but she doesn't actually write against Bukharin in public. So she does draw that line. But, of course, it costs her her post at Pravda immediately.
Yeah. I also think it's very important to kind of put this in the right context, because these people were kind of between the, at least this is my interpretation, that they were, I'm not defending them, but they were between the devil and the deep blue sea. On the one hand, they had given their entire lives to this cause, and that was the most important thing to them. And they certainly were going to do anything that was necessary in order to support that cause. On the other hand, they had personal loyalties, and they had to decide what they were going to do. And in my experience studying the Bolsheviks, they almost never chose personal loyalties. They almost always chose the party, because it was just that much more important to them. And this was true across the board, across personality types, across genders. The cause was more important. And if that meant somebody had to be sacrificed, then they were. And they were ready to be sacrificed themselves.
Yes, absolutely. It's the time of that massive conflict that's on the go between personal loyalties and party loyalty is horrific. And you get sort of not very much, but you get small snippets in letters from Krupskaya or letters from Maria talking about the strains that they're undergoing and how Maria seemed to be crying as Bukharin has denounced at party congress and so on.
Yeah, exactly.
But you're right. They will fall silent. They won't defend the people who are being expelled from the party.
Yeah, I think it's understandable if you look at their entire histories, how they came to do this. Again, I'm not excusing or anything, but I'm saying, look, they're just people. So then one thing that I was particularly interested in, and this might seem like something of a digression, but so Maria is removed from her post at Pravda, correct?
Now,
is at that point, does she go to, and I may be wrong here, does she go to work for something called the Department of Complaints?
Yes.
Is that when she does this? I find this Department of Complaints thing fascinating, so fascinating that I even looked at the footnotes. Because at one point you say there are they're a treasure trove of these things. There's a huge number of these complaints. Do they still exist?
Yes.
Has anybody studied these things?
I think that it's something that's coming to the attention of historians of that period. What we're seeing now in new research into the 30s is that it's usually seen as kind of this time of mass state repression where everyone is simply made to be submissive and no one will speak against the regime and so on. But actually,
I can't remember the figure, but you said in 1 year there was 35,000 of them or something. I mean, there's a very
absolutely.
Large
there's,
number.
There's this huge amount of letter writing going on where peasants, workers, and so on are directly appealing to the party for injustices to be overturned. I mean, they seem to have a very clear idea of what their rights are.
It sounds like an absolutely incredible source. Maybe I'll go work on it. I don't know.
That's the thing about researching Maria, is that there's so many different avenues it could be taken even further with more time.
It's truly remarkable. So she's removed from her post at Pravda, goes to work at the Department of Complaints, and intermittently she is also involved in, as you said, writing party history and working on Lenin's collected works and this kind of thing. Is that right? How does she do that? What does she do there?
It's something that they all sort of carve a niche for themselves in doing. Basically, sort of, Lenin had a great sense of his own historical importance, even from the early stages. So he was meticulous in keeping his correspondence, his letters, his papers, and so on. So there's a whole sort of world of work available to Maria and to Anna and Krupskaya even, where they can sort of hide themselves away from the world a bit, work in what's going to become the Lenin Library. And simply put his papers together, and it's very innocuous, but it still gives them the protection, if you like, of Lenin's name in the face of Stalin's displeasure with him, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. And do they write popular books at this time about Lenin and about the early party?
Yes, I mean, they're very keen to they quite often write short papers about Lenin's childhood and so on, which are deliberately aimed at young people. They kind of are holding Lenin up essentially as a model of communist behavior that they want young people to emulate. Right.
So that was sort of a safe place for them in the 30s, because they were not repressed.
No, I mean, apart from being very aware that they were out of favour, that they couldn't be seen with people who had been their colleagues and friends for years, and so on. But is it, that's about as far as Stalin goes.
Mm-hmm.
Anna, of course, has one last run-in with Stalin, where working on Lenin's, you know, history and Lenin's biography and her family history, she discovers that Lenin actually had Jewish roots.
Yeah, no,
and,
that's right. Yeah.
There's sort of a brief. A very brief but discussion where Anna keeps campaigning to Stalin, saying we really ought to publish this. It would help, you know, ease anti-Semitism in the Soviet Union and so on. But Stalin says absolutely not, and in fact gets Maria to go to Anna and tell her so. So.
I see. That's very interesting. So, Anna dies in 1935. Is that right?
Yes.
Yes. Since she is a person of some importance, how is she? How is her death treated by the state?
Well, she doesn't get, if you like, the full Kremlin,
the full treatment. Yeah.
No, but she is her body is displayed in Moscow. There are crowds in the street. But she, in fact, had decided she wanted to be buried in St. Petersburg, where her sister Olga, her mother, and her husband were
her
all buried.
Husband was
so,
buried, yeah.
And I was just there actually in the Easter time. There's in the cemetery there's statues to each of them, and you know, a sort of, you know, a special platform over the graves to commemorate them.
So she's buried in St. Petersburg, and then 2 years later,
yes,
Maria dies,
yes,
at a ripe old age, and how are her remains treated?
Well, in classic Stalin style, where he was always often prepared to give big funerals to people he, you know, he was secretly glad to be rid of, she gets full treatment. Her ashes are displayed, and then she's buried in the Kremlin wall, and so it's essentially, you know, you get sort of small square plaques put on the walls to show where they are, and you know, she joins the ranks of many of the old Bolsheviks who've fallen shortly after the revolution. So
yeah, that's the best. We should point out that's the best treatment you could get in the
well,
with one exception that we're going to talk about presently. So she gets the full treatment. She gets the Kolonizol, and she gets the long sort of parade of dignitaries and the mass mourning and wearing black and radio blackouts and that kind of stuff.
Yeah
she gets the whole thing. So this is a question that you don't touch on, but I really found it. I really kind of I hunger for an answer. What did they think about the Lenin mausoleum? I mean, now Maria still lived in the Kremlin, right?
Yes.
And so Volodya was right outside.
Yeah, it's something actually that I know. I mean, it must have been extraordinary.
It's just creepy.
Oh well, absolutely. I mean,
it's creepy.
Absolutely. I mean, I know that the whole family was opposed, but it actually, and I know that they sent letters to Stalin asking him, obviously, not to go ahead with it. But then, you know, whereas we know that Krupskaya went to the mausoleum and so on, there's no references at all. I couldn't find anything in their letters or where they spoke about his tomb or
The family itself was opposed to the embalming and construction of the mausoleum?
Very much so, yeah.
Has the history of that been written? Is there anybody who's written?
There's a fabulous book called Lenin's Embalmers, which sort of goes through the horrible, grisly details of how they actually obviously embalmed him. But there's a brief discussion about the family's objections. I believe Lenin wanted to be buried in St. Petersburg, like his sister.
Knowing Lenin, I'm sure he wanted to be buried in St. Petersburg with a plaque about the site as a post-it note.
Yeah, probably.
Vladimir Ilyich Lenin lived, you know, was born and died, and that was it.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he was not big on the cult of personality thing. So how were Maria and Anna treated in Soviet historiography after their death?
Well, the first thing that happens is silence. Just as when Krupskaya dies, she's not really supposed to be spoken about again. There's about a 10-year period where there's nothing written about them, and they're simply sort of taken out of the public view. After that, obviously all their own works about Lenin are published again, so that brings them back into the public eye. Mm-hmm. There's plays written about them. There's a glowing collection of reminiscences about Maria's time at Pravda, where everyone talks about how Well, she almost becomes like a godlike figure. You know, she could see into your soul. She could solve all the problems. She didn't have to shout. But she just commanded everyone. You know, she could lead beautifully. And
that's just like my boss. If he's listening, are you there? No, okay, go ahead.
and Anna, to an extent, gets the same kind of treatment. So she was slightly less of a public figure, but you get these sort of glowing reports. I suppose the last stage of the historiography, though, is that a lot of the autobiographical material that the sisters wrote is taken very much at face value, and you do get this increasing portrayal of the sisters in English language history as sort of satellites of Lenin, who didn't actually have an independent career at all. And obviously it was that element of the historiography that I wanted to address in the book, sort of restoring their independent careers, their own political views.
And you do a fine job of it. I mean, that starts very early, and it really does start with Lenin's opponents. It really does start. I think it starts with Trotsky.
Yes.
He was quite a guy, Trotsky.
Well,
he was quite a guy.
I mean, he had no reason to like Maria, because Maria was very firmly against him, and, you know, blanked him on a number of social occasions and was very clearly on Stalin's side. So you can understand, perhaps, you know, some of his anger, but he uses very sort of specific attacks, you know, like the loveless old spinster and so on, you know, personal attacks.
Yeah, he was a mean guy. Mm. I mean, Trotsky was mean. There's just no question about it. He was a mean guy. And he had this kind of rapier pen, which he loved to trash people. He was just really very infatuated with his own, you know, ability to put people in the gutter. He's a very interesting, angry guy, angry guy. So Stalin dies in 1953, and then in 1956, it's 1956, right, that the famous speech. Since they were never really repressed, are they rehabilitated in any way, or does the image change at all after 1956?
Because they were never really attacked, and they were never really attacked openly in the press or anything like that. So the key thing was just allowing them to be spoken about again, and just as Khrushchev's speech began to kind of, if you like, revive the Lenin personality cult. Similarly, the fascination with his family revived as well, and you know, huge amount of publications talking about the sisters. People, you know, when I met Lenin, when I met Maria, when I met Anna, and that kind of thing. And a lot simply actually collected in the archives, some of which went unpublished. But I find a lot of people writing in letters and so on, talking about their memories of the sisters.
I see. So, how are they viewed today in post-Soviet times? Are they remembered at all? I mean, is there any, I was thinking, for example, you know, Russians love to go put flowers on graves. Do people go to their graves on their birthdays?
Well, when I was there at Easter time, there were flowers on the grave. But I have to say, I've never had a very positive reaction when I've said I've researched Lenin's sisters. A lot of people would say, "Boff, they were nobodies," or other people will say, "Oh, look at Alexander, he's much more interesting."
Yeah,
so,
right.
So I've often sort of come across, you know, just a lack of interest, or even a sort of hostility towards, you know, towards the that as a project. I don't know if, again, it's because it's a woman's topic, or if I don't know. I've never been able to see it.
I don't know either. I mean, it's interesting because I was sitting in on what does one call it? Not an oral's defense, but somebody's comprehensive exams yesterday. And a couple of the people in the room, my colleagues, study female, they study nuns and female religious in the 12th, 13th, and 14th centuries, and they study them as intellectuals because they left quite a bit of writing. But it's difficult to talk about them because, of course, they weren't allowed to attend university at the time. So none of them are scholars in a literal sense.
Yeah.
None of them can be doctors. None of them are, in fact, they are not. They can't study theology because that's a formal discipline. And I think that they face a kind of similar problem. You know, how does one talk about the contribution of a group of people that was never institutionally recognized, but nonetheless was important? It's a tricky thing, I think. But I think you negotiated very well by just focusing on them, and that's really, I think, what you have to do: them and what they write, and because, you know, they have to negotiate. And this is something that we that I think we forget in this. You know, it's funny. My My wife is quite a feminist, you know, and it's always interesting hearing her perspective on things because, you know, from my chair, you know, it's as if the feminist revolution has succeeded and that's all over now and there's no more gender or anything to negotiate or anything like that. But that's just not true.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, but that's the way it seems to me. And I think that, you know, in their day, they really had to negotiate a great number of barriers that are lost to us. And that's one of the great virtues of your book is that you present them again to us and you show that there were ways in which they could speak, there were things in which they could do, there were paths open to them that were determined precisely by the fact they were women. Period. End of story.
Yeah.
And in that way, I think that you've done just a really terrific job. Because again, and maybe it's only true of Americans or something, but we tend to look at these things and just say, enough already, I don't want to think about this anymore. I don't know what it is, you know. It's a remarkable. We don't want to remember the past. We want to think that it's things are perfect. But you know, I want to thank you very much for spending so much time with us today.
It's been
really terrific. Let me ask you our traditional final question, Katie. What are you working on now?
Well, I have to say, I'm not really leaving this topic. I was so struck by how important family ties were to Lenin and his ability to function as a revolutionary that I've decided to open up my investigation and look at how families of other revolutionaries were part of a wider movement. So I'm looking at who married whom within the revolutionary movement,
how
they coped with having children, parents intervened on their behalf, you know, obstructed police repression and so on. And I'm just looking at how the revolutionary movement in the underground period was essentially sustained by people who chipped in from the sides due to sort of family loyalties and kept the revolutionary movement going in sort of almost imperceptible ways, but in a way that I think will help bring more attention as well to the role that women played.
I think that's terrific too. You know, again, it's kind of a page out. I studied early modern Russian history for a long time, and who was married to whom was the fundamental question.
That was really all
that mattered. And I sort of suspect it's still somewhat true. You know, I mean, that still matters to be honest with you. But in those days, I think it was extraordinarily important. And I think it's a fantastic topic. And as soon as you're done, I want you to promise me that you will call me and we'll interview you about that project.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, Katie Turton, thanks very much. The book is Forgotten Lives, The Role of Lenin's Sisters in the Russian Revolution, 1864 to 1937. I enjoyed reading it, and I enjoyed talking to you. So thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks, Katie. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Katie Turton, author of Forgotten Lives, The Role of Lenin's Sisters in the Russian Revolution, 1864 to 1937. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History, and I hope to talk to you next week.